Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
I want to turn now to Ukraine, though, where overnight strikes in Kyiv have killed at least six people, including a six-year-old boy, and left more than 50 wounded, according to Ukrainian officials. A barrage of Russian drones and missiles reportedly struck several districts across Kyiv and brought down an apartment block. For more, we're joined on the line by James Waterhouse, BBC Ukraine correspondent. Good morning, James. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. What more can you tell us about these overnight strikes?
Well, it's a yet another bad one for Kyiv. There's some very difficult images coming out of rescue teams sifting through rubble, where in one case an apartment block was destroyed. There was a woman being carried out, or the body of a woman being carried out in her pajamas. We're told at least six people have been killed. And it seems, according to Ukraine's defense ministry, that more than 300 Russian drones and cruise missiles were launched. And they often publish these maps which show the flight path of these drones as they make their way in. And they weave and wind to try and overcome Ukraine's defenses. And typically there is a pattern where you'll hear air defenses go off, you'll hear rumbles in the distance, you'll hear 50 caliber machine gun going into the air. And then you'll hear the dull thunderclap of impact. And for Kyivites living in the city, nights like this typically involve either heading to the shelter or rolling over in bed or going to the corridor and hoping it's not your turn. But at the moment, we're seeing this strange arms race where Ukraine is trying to manufacture interceptor drones to intercept, to take out the Russian drones coming in. And they are devastating. They do affect morale. They change little on the battlefield, but it's putting a strain on Ukraine as it continues to look westward for more help.
And what is happening to the air defences? Are the numbers of missiles and drones coming in just overwhelming them, or are those air defences under-resourced now?
The stockpiles are not clear. But at the moment, over 6 months ago, the interception rate was about 95%. But of course, it just takes one cruise missile or a drone packed with 90 kilos of explosives to cause devastation. That has now dropped to around 80 to 85%. And I think if you just look at the numbers, we're talking about 300 last night. The last weekend I was in Kyiv, more than 1,000 were launched over 3 days. And so the Ukrainians are obviously going to be reluctant to launch an expensive missile. And they're also trying to find ways to try and match it. But despite all of the pledges from Donald Trump, who's given the green light for American weapons to be sold to Ukraine, not least with these Patriot missile systems, the quantity and timings are not yet clear as European allies look to either purchase them or provide Ukraine with their own systems. But this is an arms race which only favours Russia because of its mass and deeper resources.
James, Donald Trump had issued a 50-day ultimatum to the Kremlin. That has been shortened to a 10-day ultimatum. Is there any sign that has changed Russia's calculations here?
Not at the moment. If you look at the Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, if you look at the former president, Medvedev, they're basically saying, look, these ultimatums, we'll take them seriously, but they amount to nothing. The Russian papers are more focused on the deterioration, once again, between relations between Moscow and Washington. And for now, you're hearing Russia say, look, we are still focused on our goals, what it calls the root causes of the Ukraine crisis. And that, for me, is a symptom that Vladimir Putin isn't feeling enough external pressure yet to reconsider. Now, if Donald Trump is serious when he says they've got 10 or 12 days, I don't know, in his words, which will start, I make it next week. If he does bring in tariffs on Moscow's trading partners like India, like China, and when it comes to doing deals with America, would that then put pressure on the Kremlin? You would think. I mean, that does sound significant, more significant than secondary sanctions. as of now, I think until we see such an implementation, the Kremlin, outwardly at least, is not concerned.
Since April, it's been hard to take Donald Trump at face value on anything that he's had to say about tariffs. But I wonder, would the imposition of a 15% tariff on a friendly trading partner like the EU bloc not give Russia a little bit of pause?
Well, I mean, on that 15% tariff, you know, there are critics within Europe, as you know, on it being a less favourable deal for the bloc. But I wonder, you know, when you see this deal finally be thrashed out, and then you see Donald Trump clearly more engaged than he has been in a security sense, where he's been less afraid to shorten that ultimatum for Moscow. He's already given the green light, as I say, with the Western weapons. I think that is sort of causing or triggering a bit of relative unity we've not seen before. But of course, you're right. You know, there is an unpredictability here that is unhelpful for Ukraine, but clearly we're not talking about Ukraine either, you know, hanging on. It's simply about winning. It's simply about letting Ukraine hang on until an eventual negotiation, which Donald Trump would hope to take credit for.
You make a very good point at the outset there about missiles being launched at Kyiv being of absolutely no military consequence to the prosecution of this war, that they just terrorize the civilian population. What is happening on those fronts in the east of the country? Who's winning? Who's losing?
Well, I mean, Ukraine only loses. You know, I think in 2022, when it liberated territory in some cities, I thought, God, they could just do it, when the world thought that Russian forces would be in Kyiv within a matter of days. But in a war of attrition, where you are being invaded, you only lose. It's Ukraine is losing more territory in the east. There are three cities that I've been to frequently: Konstantinivka, Kupiansk, and Pokrovsk. And these are places that when the Russians get closer to, they are drained of life, they are reduced to rubble. The situation is described by Ukrainian soldiers there as critical. There are drone impacts as far as 30 kilometers from the front line. So whether or not these cities fall, they are uninhabitable. And, you know, we're not talking about Ukrainian forces going forward, and we're talking about hundreds of soldiers dying every week in the process. I mean, Russia's tactics are hugely costly for Moscow, with the, you know, wave after wave of attack, typically riding on motorbikes. But, you know, Ukraine only loses until there is enough pressure on Moscow, either through sanctions in the long term after the war ends, to regain territory. But at the moment, Ukraine has lost territory, is losing men to prevent further territory to go the same way. Its economy is under huge strain and has to be propped up by Western allies. Its democracy is still under an existential threat. And the price it is paying for this defence will be felt for decades, you know, economically, on a societal level, when you look at the cost people are paying.
Meanwhile, on the political front, or at least domestically, Ukraine is presenting far from a unified face to Russia, because President Volodymyr Zelensky is under the spotlight this morning. There's this crucial vote taking place in the parliament on the overturning of a highly criticised law, where he had tried to bring two anti-corruption bodies that were supposed to be independent underneath the control of the presidency. How do you think that's going to pan out, and what way is it being viewed in Russia?
Well, I mean, the Russian propagandists probably could have taken the week off last week. you know, they try and portray Zelensky as an illegitimate leader, despite, you know, his democratic mandate. And yet, you know, Zelensky's had to do a complete U-turn. It's been a huge damage on his authority. As you say, he was looking to bring two anti-corruption bodies under direct governmental oversight. And now he is reversing it. There is a vote on that today. It is expected to go through. And it triggered days of demonstrations. You know, Ukrainians are hugely sensitive to attacks on their democracy. Yes, it is a country that does grapple with corruption. Zelensky argued that it would minimize Russian influence within the department itself. But clearly, this has been a huge damage to his authority. It is an embarrassing U-turn. And I think the sight of demonstrations in the midst of an ongoing full-scale invasion have been, let's put it mildly, far from helpful from Ukraine's perspective.
Zelensky is trying to retool the entire Ukrainian industry towards a war footing and towards supplying soldiers on the front. How essential do you think, and there's no delicate way of saying this, how essential is a little bit of corruption, a little bit of greasing the wheels in order to do that when you're in the middle of an existential war?
Well, it's not great. I think, you know, with the influx of billions of dollars of military and economic aid, you are expected to clean up your acts. And I think in my 3.5 years in Ukraine, there have been some incredibly damaging revelations where there have been, you know, dodgy procurements of military helmets, for example, army helmets, to the tune of millions of pounds, where high senior officials have enriched themselves. But equally, the agencies tasked with combating them have gone public and gone public early. But of course, as you say, certainly with this law that they've had to reverse, the European Union was less than impressed, and it would only have harmed Ukraine's accession chances in the long run. So it is something that's seen as necessary to combat in tandem with prosecuting its defence on the battlefield. But you know, Ukraine is a young country. It gained independence in the early 90s. It went through a tumultuous period when some saw it as having the best chance of going its own way as an independent country. It probably looks at the likes of Estonia and Latvia and thinks, why couldn't we have done the same? And it has been riddled with corruption, but it has been on the mend. It has been improving. I mean, you consider the war that surrounds it, that is saying something, but it's still very much a problem.
Obviously, an election is unfeasible, and I don't know, is there any mechanism for putting somebody else into the presidency that would command any level of popular support? So what happens here now? Does Volodymyr Zelensky just soldier on, somewhat wounded, somewhat compromised?
Yeah, I mean, we had an off the record. We had a briefing with the president a couple of months ago where we sat in his office, and I looked at him and just thought, I don't know how he keeps going. There are times when he's made public appearances and he looks exhausted, and you know, this war is his political being. He wears it. He feels it. You do sense that. But you know, on the question of elections, they are legally postponed under martial law, which is enshrined in the constitution. So, you know, there is public support for that. Some of his staunchest critics and rivals have supported Zelensky as the legitimate leader. You know, former President Poroshenko, who Zelensky recently sanctioned, stood up in front of a camera and said, he is the right man for now. So, you know, there's that, the legal side. And then, of course, there is the practical side. Like, how on earth would you stage an election where, you know, there are shells raining down, say, close to the front line, when a fifth of the country is occupied? And this has been a problem that's plagued Ukraine since Russia's aggression first started in 2014. Moscow continually tries to have some kind of stake, some kind of influence in Ukrainian politics, because this always loops back to the fact that the Kremlin wants to pull Ukraine closer to its orbit. And that, for Ukrainians, is still a political non-starter.
James Waterhouse, thank you very much for that analysis, the BBC's Ukraine correspondent. Coming up next, why Irish farmers need to put more thought into their pensions and planning for their financial future.
Get in touch on WhatsApp 0870 32 32 32.